This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Hear about whether Illinois farmers can count on Trump administration efforts to soften trade war effects with deals for new exports.
There's a lot of difference between signing a contract and making a commitment to purchase and actually exporting. So I'm from Missouri originally. You have to show me.
American Farm Bureau economist Veronica Nye speaks with Ryan Denham. American birth rates are falling. This is International Child Free Day, celebrating those who choose to not parent. Dana Vollmer talks with a Bradley University scholar about the reasons people make that decision. And the Islamic Center of Bloomington Normal is partnering with the West Market Street Council to help low-income kids get ready for school. All that and a GLT News update on the way. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from GLT listeners. Join the community of news consumers who listen to Sound Ideas and are also willing to support it financially. Learn more about listener-supported radio and GLT at WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Illinois farmers have a lot of questions about U.S. trade policy, like when the dispute with China will get resolved or if the U.S.-Mexico-Canada agreement will pass through Congress. American Farm Bureau economist Veronica Nye speaks with farmers this week to provide some answers. She was a featured speaker at yesterday's Illinois Farm Bureau Income and Innovations Conference in Normal. WGLT's Ryan Denham caught up with her about the outlook for exports through the lens of trade, treaties, and tariffs.
I think the way I'd have to describe it best is muddled. There's a lot of things going in favor of U.S. ag exports. The fundamentals that have always been true about U.S. agriculture are still there. We're still a low-cost producer of most items. We have a strong transportation system, and we're reliable suppliers. Coupled, unfortunately, on the producer side with fairly low commodity prices, but that makes us pretty competitive in a global market. Now, that being said, the policy side has become more challenging over the last couple of years. I think the discussion on trade has changed. I don't know if that's forever change or just short term, but certainly the situation we find ourselves in with China casts a lot of shadows onto U.S. ag exports. Last year was down from 2017, and we're expecting a further decline in 2019 as compared to last year. So continuing downward pressure from China, even though we're getting a lot of pickup of additional purchases from other partners.
Well, speaking of the shadow being cast with the situation with China, I imagine it would be easy to be pessimistic. You attend a conference like this, and you're hearing things, you're getting updates on where things stand, and it's obviously a challenging time for farmers right now. What do you want people to take away from your remarks? What is sort of the mood you're going to be trying to strike with where we are, where we're going?
Well, certainly it's not all doom and gloom. The administration has been working hard with the House Democrats, with Congress at large, to try to get USMCA passed. Certainly we've welcomed a lot of our members from all over the United States into our offices in D.C., making those Hill visits. So certainly from the standpoint of USMCA, the revision of NAFTA, there's a lot, I think, to be positive about. That agreement, as we know, has done a lot for U.S. agriculture. We went from exporting about $9 billion per year prior to that agreement to $40 billion per year. So, you know, about a third of U.S. ag exports now go to Canada and Mexico. We know how important that market is. And I think once we get this passed through Congress, it really sets the stage for other trade partners that the U.S. is willing and able to complete trade agreements, and then we can get them passed through Congress. That will be incredibly important, I think, for U.S. agriculture, for the U.S. economy at large. But as we look forward to engaging in new trade agreements or maybe more positive expansions of trade, that certainly sets a positive tone. But I don't want to be Pollyanna-ish. There's a lot of headwinds as well. Unfortunately, on the China side, I think an outcome is not a positive outcome or total resolution of our issues with China. isn't on the near horizon. So it's a balancing act of staying positive on trade and recognize how important it is to the industry and trying to seek new opportunities while still paying a lot of attention to that big market that has been challenging the last couple of years.
And I want to get back to USMCA, the United States-Mexico-Canada agreement, but a couple more questions on China. As trade negotiations have gone on between the U.S. and China, has China actually bought some amount of soybeans? Has it been enough to make any meaningful difference to American farmers, or have those numbers still been very, very low?
Indeed, China has bought some soybeans. They've made some commitments to buy some soybeans, which there's a lot of difference between signing a contract and making a commitment to purchase and actually exporting. So we always view those. I'm from Missouri originally. You have to show me the actual exports. And I think the whole ag sector is kind of in that space right now. So we're excited about those commitments to purchase. Though, to be honest, they pale in comparison to where we were just 2 years ago. So more so than significant market impact, it's more, I think, maybe a commitment of goodwill by the Chinese that we do intend to buy U.S. ag products. We still enjoy U.S. ag products, and we intend to continue this relationship into the future. But as far as making a dent in the hole we've sort of dug for ourselves, it's a teaspoon where we've taken out a shovel of dirt.
Are there other buyers of big scale for our soybeans internationally? Any other developing economies that could pick up some of what we've lost with China?
Back in, let's see, it would have been around March or April, the total U.S. exports for the calendar year 2018 came out. And we saw that actually ag exports increased by value by 1% in 2018 compared to 2017. And I think that surprised a lot of people. But the big driver, as you alluded to, are that we've had other countries step up. They've made additional purchases. Now, when you have a market that's more than 50% of your total exports of a particular commodity, it takes a lot of growth in a lot of smaller markets to try to make up for that large market. We haven't got there yet, I'll be honest. We still have a lot of soybeans in storage from last year. We're looking at a good production year this year, there's a lot of concern about what the soybean market's going to look like going into the fall and winter. But certainly we have had additional purchases. The EU made some big purchases last year. The Mexicans continue to be good purchasers. So there's a lot of sort of small-scale additions that are going on. But, again, it takes a lot of those to add up to that big loss that we've seen from China.
Well, let's circle back then to something you alluded to before, USMCA, the United States-Mexico-Canada Agreement. Where does that stand as of now in its efforts to get it through Congress?
Well, right now, Congress is about to take their summer break, and so there was a lot of hope that USMCA might get voted on before the summer break, but obviously that's not going to happen. Right now, it appears as if the cards will line up. Fingers crossed, you can't see me in this radio, but I'm crossing all my fingers, that we could look at a September-October vote on USMCA. So right now, the administration has fulfilled all of the obligations that they are mandated to do through the Trade Promotion Authority. That TPA makes it so when a trade agreement is sent over to Congress, they just have an up or down vote, and it only has to pass by a simple majority, whereas you could imagine sending a trade agreement up without Trade Promotion Authority. Certainly, you would have a lot of negotiators, probably somewhere around 535. So TPA makes it so that there's a few more rules around what the administration has to do when negotiating a trade agreement. So the good news is they've done all this. The next step will be for the administration to send the implementing legislation to Congress, and then the votes will occur. The first vote has to occur in the House because there are tariff implications and therefore revenue implications. So any revenue bill has to start in the House. So all eyes are right there. Of course, everyone knows that Democrats have control of the House and Republicans control of the Senate. I think generally folks think that the Senate vote will be fairly easy. You should never call a trade vote easy, but easy enough. So all of the focus has been on the House side. Speaker Pelosi has done an excellent job of corralling her caucus and saying, okay, what are the problems that we think we have with this agreement? They've put them into four different buckets, and she's put nine different representatives on these four sort of issues, and they've been actively negotiating with USTR to try to find a resolution. All of the communication and all that we've seen between both the House Democrats and USTR is that relationship has been very good, that there have been a lot of active meetings, a lot of face-to-face, and that folks believe that they're negotiating in earnest. So over this summer break, August recess, we would expect there to continue to be active work between the House and USTR so that when they come back in September, we're ready to go.
Last week, Secretary of Agriculture Sonny Perdue unveiled details of the latest aid package for farmers who've lost export sales for all the reasons we've just talked about. It includes $14 billion in direct payments to farmers. There's been an analysis from University of Missouri's Food and Ag Policy Research Institute that last year's aid package actually overpaid farmers. Other ag economists have come to the same conclusion. What have you seen? What is the American Farm Bureau's sense of how much is the right amount for these very large direct payment programs?
Well, I think we've been fairly clear throughout this trade dispute that we'd much rather get our income and our sales from the market rather than from a government program. The level of payment also is fairly clear that we are not making up for the lost sales that we would have seen. Certainly, USDA is using a trade model to try to estimate the total impact. That includes both direct lost sales and indirect sales. So when we look at, I'll squarely put on my economist hat, and we'll talk about opportunity costs and say that, hey, if we're still selling product, but we're having to take a pretty significant price discount because we're no longer the supplier of choice, those costs should also add in. So USDA's done yeoman's work of trying to estimate those payments and trying to do it in a timely manner. That's always something that is challenging, and we certainly appreciate all the work that they've done to get to the point where farmers in the year they're feeling the impact will have some relief. So certainly we will be debating the merits of the market facilitation program, the trade aid program, for quite some time. But we certainly appreciate all the efforts that USDA has gone into it. And I think we'll all learn quite a bit from these programs.
Do you think the past couple of years of uncertainty about trade should prompt like a larger conversation about American farm policy? You know, I've heard that there is this argument that this heavy reliance on subsidy-supported global trade is not sustainable, particularly with the situation we're in now. We've hitched our wagons to the China market, and look what it's done to us. Has this been a wake-up call for any kind of larger conversation about this big trade policy we've gotten ourselves into?
Well, I think what we have to keep in mind is that U.S. agriculture is incredibly productive. It's one of the things we do best here in the United States. We have a large country, and we're able to grow a wide variety of foods and fiber. But our productivity is outpacing U.S. Population growth, our per capita consumption. And so the only way U.S. agriculture is going to be successful into the future is to export and find customers, that 95% of customers that live outside of the United States. I think that that's going to continue to be true. And I don't think anyone in agriculture thinks otherwise. Maybe what the Chinese situation has illuminated is that reliance on one customer it can be dangerous. It can be shaky as far as making sure that you have a fairly reliable customer base. I think when you look at one of the smaller portions of the trade aid package that doesn't get as much discussion, but is the the Ag Trade Program, which is such a clever title, but it's basically more promotion dollars for U.S. export organizations to go out and promote their commodities. The last couple of days, I was at the U.S. Grains Council meeting, and they spent a lot of time talking about how they were planning to use the monies that they had received. They were planning on spending a lot more time, energy, and frankly, dollars promoting U.S. corn, soybeans, and barley in Africa, West and East Africa. They were planning on spending more money in India and other and then other South Asia countries, other Southeast Asia countries. And it's not that they didn't know that those markets had potential in the past, but there's a limit to the amount of dollars and effort that you can put forward to promoting U.S. ag exports. I think this recent trade situation has reminded us that it's better to make sure that we're fertilizing multiple markets rather than relying on one. So not to say that the Chinese market isn't important. It's incredibly important. I think that's fairly obvious. And it's an important, China is an important customer and will continue to be. But maybe we should be looking elsewhere as well and not give quite all of the spotlight to just one customer.
That's American Farm Bureau trade economist Veronica Nye speaking with GLT's Ryan Denham at the Illinois Farm Bureau's Farm Income and Innovations Conference yesterday in Normal.
Support for WGLT comes from Specs Around Town, proudly investing in downtown Bloomington with a refreshing new look for the boutique at 317 North Center Street. Specs Around Town, Central Illinois' unique optical shop since 1998. Details at specsaroundtown.com. This is 89.1 WGLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. The American birth rate is falling. Part of that is economics, part of it choice, and we'll delve into more during International Child-Free Day in just a few minutes here on 89.1 and WGLT.org. More than 5,000 children in Bloomington Normal come from families that have a tough time getting ready for school. The Islamic Center of Bloomington Normal and the West Market Street Council are partnering in an effort to help low-income kids. Arthur Haynes of the council is here to talk about tomorrow's block party on West Market Street, and Jamal Muhammad of the Islamic Center is here to talk about this new partnership.
The Islamic Circle of North America, they are a national charity organization. They are one of their main goals is helping the folks underprivileged people in North America, especially in United States. So that's one of their main goals. They are doing a lot of disaster relief. This organization mainly in Chicago, they operate, I should say, but they are widespread across the country. And we are partnering with them. They have been doing this free backpack campaign for the last 10 years. This is their 10th year. So we reached out to them, and the way they operate is they partner with some of the local organization, and they do these activities. So this one, they reached out to Islamic Center McLean County. That's the Islamic Center here in town. And they send the backpacks directly. And then local community raises the money and fills the backpack with the supplies. And that's how this whole thing shaped up. And once this being the first year we are doing it here in town, we realized, okay, we need to identify which area, who to provide these free backpacks. That's when my friend Arthur and we talked about it, and then he had some good ideas and say, hey, let's do this at the plaza.
Arthur Haynes of the West Market Street Council, how did you decide how to distribute these 100 backpacks and assorted school supplies?
Well, it was kind of a no-brainer, you know, as we are continuing on our efforts with the West Market Street Council to end the food desert in West Bloomington. We have identified a number of other resources that the residents in that community have needs for, and one of those needs being back-to-school supplies for a lot of the families. It's really rough for a lot of the families to be able to afford those. We have families in that community who are single-family households and multiple children, and you know, it's a struggle. The event also is incorporating a community effort where we want to get residents and business owners or anyone to come out and just help us spruce up the plaza. We had some flower pots donated from the city of Bloomington. They're located at the plaza. We've had some flowers donated from the West Bloomington Revitalization Project. We'll be stopping at the Tool Library on Friday to pick up some, you know, rakes and things of that nature. So it just seemed like a perfect fit. This is something that they've been doing for 10 years. And with the block party that I do, being in the ninth year, we do a huge school supply drive as well. And that'll be the following day, which is this coming Saturday. And I felt like that would be a great lead up to the block party if we can get like a pre-giveaway going and also bring some awareness to this organization and their mission across North America. So,
20% of American kids live in poverty in McLean County. It is, depending on the criteria you use and the year in which you do the assessment, between 14% and 17%. I've seen it range that widely over the last 15 years or so. And yet, poverty is not the only measure, because about half the school children in McLean County qualify for free and reduced lunches. Mm-hmm. How can this partnership be used to address those needs in an ongoing fashion?
Yes, this one really, the last 3 weeks has been the support we got from the community, and then we realized there is a lot of need in the community for this kind of an effort. And based on the numbers we looked at, there are close to almost 5,500 kids in need of the school supplies and free backpacks.
In McLean County?
Within the Bloomington Normal School, mm-hmm. Unit 87 and Unit 5. This is from kindergarten to eighth grade, we are talking. We are not even including the high schoolers. So that alone, so what we did is we kind of reached out to a couple of schools and two of the principals. One is Grove Elementary principal, Mrs. Sarah Edwards, and then we also reached out to Pepperidge Elementary School principal, Tina Fogel. So both were working with us, and we are going to be supplying backpacks to them directly. So initially we thought we'll do it with 100. Now we, based on the feedback we got from the principals, I asked them to send more free backpacks from Chicago office. So there is more coming. So our plan is going forward, we are going to focus on, at least for the coming years, we are going to focus on the elementary schools. Our biggest focus is going to make sure every one of the elementary school kids start their first day with the free backpacks. That's the ideal place we want to be. But that's how we are planning on for the future.
Obviously, you're piggybacking on a national program this year. There is also a local effort, long established, to distribute backpacks and school supplies at the Coliseum. That happens every year, and the numbers are quite high. How will you coordinate to prevent duplication of service, to really hone in on targeted need going forward?
One of the things we thought about, I looked at the efforts they are making and the local collaboration they were doing. One of the things we realized is not everyone are willing to come and just reach out in a way, hey, okay, I need this backpack. There is some reluctance in doing some of them, we noticed, within the community. So in those ones, we are trying to do it this way by reaching out to the principals. Hey, if anyone comes in, they're not willing to disclose to the level of the finance and those things, they don't want to deal with all the hassle, we thought this might help them. At the same time, we are thinking of partnering with them in the future. Maybe we will reach out to them and figure out how we can support it, or they can support us, and maybe broaden this whole effort and to avoid the duplication in the future as well.
The Islamic Center is largely centered on the east side, where your population base is, and
yes.
You, of course, Arthur, are on the west side. Is there scope for an ongoing link between the two sides of town that will benefit both sides?
Absolutely. That's where we saw this partnership as the first step of reaching out the west side and try to do more of these campaigns. We are starting with this one, but eventually we want to work on the lunch, some mm-hmm. schools that's who are going on the summertime without any food. We would like to create some kind of a campaign around it. Yeah, this, we look at it as a first step of bringing the east side of the town and towards the west side and start doing more of these kind of campaigns.
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, working with Julie McCoy with the District 87 Nutrition Department, I don't think that there'll be any barriers for us, incorporating some kind of food programming in the future. So just having those connections and continuing to build those connections, like Jamal said, I'm certain that this will bridge a gap between the two sides of town and bring those two sides of town together.
That's where we saw the need on the east side. We were, this partnership proves that how we didn't know anything about west side. Okay, where do we even distribute these backpacks? And that's when I reached out to Arthur. Yeah, don't worry about that. We know where exactly this needs to go. Mm-hmm. So this created this perfect alliance for us to figure out where the need is and how we get the source funding we needed to start working on these kind of campaigns.
Arthur Haynes of the West Market Street Council and Jamal Muhammad of the Islamic Center at Bloomington Normal. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
I'm Charlie Schlenker.
Why public radio? We turn to WGLT contributors for answers.
I'm Carrie Sandhaus.
There are a lot of answers, but also some common threads. It's fact-based. It's an avenue for lifelong learning, and it's local.
I appreciate the way GLT has fostered community conversations about different issues.
What's your answer to Why Public Radio, and will you financially support WGLT?
Please join me with your pledge. Go online to WGLT.org.
GLT is made possible by Illinois State University, home of the Illinois State Redbirds, featuring 19 teams competing at the NCAA Division I level. Illinois State promotes success in the athletic and academic arenas. News, schedules, and ticket information can be found at GoRedbirds.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Coming up, a story of first love, but not the kind of love you might think. Brianna Groh has a Next to Normal Story Slam story. Today is International Child-Free Day in recognition of adults who decide not to have children. U.S. fertility rates hit an all-time low last year at 59 births per 1,000 women. That's according to data from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Dana Vollmer talks with Bradley University Counseling Professor Dr. Lori Russell-Chapin about why younger generations are embracing a child-free lifestyle and how to reduce the stigma of that decision.
I think it's really interesting from a sociological point of view, I would guess. Statistics show we are having fewer children in about 1.7 versus 2.08. So we're having fewer children. We're also waiting. Young adults these days are waiting to get married, and then they're waiting to have children. I also think there's another piece. Because of technology, I think we are so exposed to the world that we have more opportunities and we know there are more choices. So being child-free is one of the choices that I think for many people, even my generation, that wasn't really an option. We didn't really think about it.
You did just touch on the fact that there's kind of been this cultural shift to where now it seems like more of an option to choose to not have children. Mm-hmm. There are some other factors that I would imagine are contributing to these changes. Can you touch on those?
I do think some of the young adults are more thoughtful. Maybe you could say they're more selfish even, but because being a parent is very selfless. But I think this generation is much more thoughtful, and they're thinking about the earth. I mean, if we have so many babies, can we even house those babies? So I think they're thinking about that. I think they're thinking about the ecology. I think there are financial issues. I mean, when I got out of college, I had a job. Getting out of college this day and age doesn't mean you have a job. So there are tons of reasons I think young adults are saying, maybe I want to be child-free.
And I would imagine that another piece of this might be the changing vision of what a family looks like. So having both parents be working full-time, only having single parents. Can you touch on that a little bit?
Both parents working is certainly an issue because they are more thoughtful. I don't have time to do this. But I also think it's not just that. I think we're more diverse as a society. I mean, so we could be heterosexual, homosexual, we could be transgendered. I mean, there's so many other choices that way as well. So I do think that that's making a difference in this whole evolution of choosing to be child-free.
What are some of the factors that people should be considering when they're looking at the decision to have kids or not to have kids?
One of the issues, I think, is just being thoughtful about, do I want to be a parent? I mean, I think that we're at an age where people just had babies, and they didn't really think about what does it mean to be a parent. But I think we are very educated these days, even sociological and psychological, and to ask the question, why do I want to be a parent? That's a great question, by the way. I mean, it's a really important question to ask. If it's just because I think I have great genes or I want to pass them on, not necessarily a good reason to have children. But to think about, why do I want to be a parent? Maybe because I really want to give back. It'll be my way of giving back. So I think that you have to be thoughtful about this. And I even think strategic.
You yourself kind of had the personal experience of going from thinking that you weren't going to have kids to later adopting. Can you kind of talk about your story and why you made those decisions?
I always wanted to be a mother. I'm not sure I thought about why I wanted to be it. Not until I was infertile did I have to, or going through that process, did I think about, well, really, why do I want to do this? And I think it was, for me, I was so fortunate to be raised in a loving and healthy family. So it was very disappointing for me not to be able to have children. We were pestered, honestly, by people who would say, when are you going to have children? When are you going to have children? Why aren't you having children? And so I do think that young couples, if they're in the process or they're thinking about having children, need to have a comeback. Some kind of mantra that says, so people can know that perhaps that's a personal question. It's really not a question that involves you. It was easy for me because I could say I'm infertile and they'd go, oh, and then they never asked me the question ever again. But I think there are other mantras I think you could say. We're choosing to have a career first. But I think you have to have something so you're not surprised. I do think today and age, if there are infertility issues, it's so much better than it was when I was trying to have children. Because we went through in vitro, it just didn't work. And so we decided to be child-free, and honestly, it was a great solution. And we were really happy with that solution, but I kept asking the question, why do I want to be a parent? And when I finally came down to why I wanted a parent, it wasn't biological. It was I really wanted to care for somebody. And so to me, adoption became a very easy issue. Once you answer the question, then you know which direction you want to go. If you answer the question, I don't think I want to be a parent. I mean, I've had clients in my private practice who say, I have really bad genes. I do not want to pass them on. That's a great reason not to be a parent, right? That on one hand, but if you just want to love someone and you want to be healthy and helpful to someone in the universe, well, adoption would be a good, you know, a good way to do it. I think, but there are other ways. You don't have to adopt. And what I think is so interesting about often people who are child-free, they do say, I want to give back. I want to be on a foundation. I want to be on a board of directors. I want to be a foster parent. I want to do big brothers and big sisters. So there are so many ways to give back.
And so you kind of touched on the idea that even though there are these social shifts that we're seeing, the stigma has not totally been removed from being child-free, either by choice or for physical reasons. And you mentioned having a mantra. So when somebody asks you why you don't have kids, having an answer to that, what are some of the things that people are hearing from others who are not understanding of their decision to not have kids, and kind of how would they respond to those kinds of ideas?
I think the biggest argument is just that's the way it's always been. I mean, and we do need to populate the earth. I mean, we can't just stop having children. But I think the best response, perhaps, is to educate. Educate people on the side who want to have children and educate the people on the side who want to be child-free. There's room in the world for everything. But I think many times people are ignorant. They're naive about our choices. And so I think if you want to be child-free, teach people. You know, if you choose, you can also be very assertive, and the definition of assertion is mutual respect. So you could say, I respectfully decline to answer your question. Or you can say, you know, I'll share with you why we want to be child-free.
Can we maybe circle back a little bit to the different financial barriers that having children can pose? Because I would imagine that is a really big piece of the puzzle as to why a lot of people are not choosing to have kids, especially within younger generations now.
Even of the cost of college these days. I mean, a lot of the young people I know are paying off incredible student debts. It's kind of hard to have a baby if you're paying off your student debt. Although, you know, if you're having low interest rate, that's helpful. But I think it's really, financially, it's huge. I mean, we have young adults now. And they're still expensive. It's a huge responsibility. And then what if there are medical issues? I mean, I don't think we're probably really good financial planners often. So we might have a small nest egg to have children. But do you think about what if you have a financial concern or if the health of the parent? I mean, we have to be fiscally responsible to raise a child. And I don't think we are thoughtful about that.
Something I think is also important to touch on when we talk about family planning in general, and you did kind of touch on this, we do have people who are transgendered. We have people who are gender non-binary. How do we kind of change the narrative to make sure that when we talk about families and parents, that's inclusive of everyone that can have a child?
I've been preaching, perhaps because this is what I do for a living, but about educating people. But I also think it's a political issue. I mean, I think we need to advocate and help people understand that there is much diversity in the universe. I do think people who are child-free often have the opportunity to travel the world, to experience different things. And that, I think, gives them a greater appreciation of diversity. But the answer has to be education and advocacy, especially the population of child-free people. They need to say, and not be defensive about it. Just think, it's okay for me to have this choice. And I'd love to share, if they're willing, why we choose to do this. I mean, maybe it's because they want to have white carpet and white couches.
That's Lori Russell Chapin, a counseling professor at Bradley University, speaking with reporter Dana Vollmer on International Child Free Day. Russell Chapin says technology offers support systems for those choosing to be child free, and it's important to consult those in making such decisions. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker, and you're listening to 89.1 and WGLT.org. Still to come, the music of National Park Radio. Ah, first love. Your stomach's in knots, your face lights up when they walk into a room. You'll do anything to spend more time with that one person. This next-to-normal storyteller felt something similar the first time she met her father. GLT correspondent Brianna Groh brings us more from the June Next to Normal Story Slam.
Growing up, Jawanika Johnson looked different from everyone around her.
I always felt a disconnect because I don't look like my mother. I don't look like any of my siblings. My father is Jamaican American. We tend to be more African featured, more full bodied. My mother is slender. Her father is half Caucasian, so her features are more Caucasian. So I look very different. If you saw my sisters and myself, you'd be like, Right? And that's how I always felt like, wherever. I don't fit nowhere, you know.
Johnson didn't know she looked like her father because she didn't meet her father until she was 14 years old. Johnson's mother raised her and her siblings in Israel until one day she announced they were moving to America. After a long plane trip overseas, Johnson waited with her family to meet her dad.
And all of a sudden, walking straight down the aisle, I see this chunky black man with a big afro that was curled. He had an S curl. And he had to be like, you know how big airports are. He had to be like a mile away before he got to us. I swear, his smile lit the whole way. He smiled all the way. He had to be smiling from the time he got in his car till he got there, because when I saw him, all we could see was this big giant smile. And so I remember looking at him and thinking, oh, he's kind of weird looking. Like my mother talk about I look like him, but he looks weird to me. Like, why is he smiling so hard? Like, why you got this big cheese? So he walks up to us and, oh, he's so excited. He's so ecstatic to see us. And he said, hi, baby. Hi, Jawanika. Now, he's saying Jawanika, but in Israel, my name is Enea. So I'm like, who are you talking to? And my mother's like, that's your American name. You know, you was born in the States, you have an American name. And I'm like, oh, okay. And he comes and he gives me this big juicy kiss. Like, my dad's kiss leaves a big glob of slob on your cheek. He like, you know, he got these big old juicy lips, you know? And so I'm just like, oh, this is so weird, you know? So we get in there and I swear this man never stopped grinning. I don't think he stopped grinning for 2 weeks. The first 2 weeks we were there, he was so happy we were there. So we're sitting in the car and he drives us to his apartment. And he's like, you know, did your mother tell you that I was magical? Magical? We were just like, no. He's like, watch this. You see that window up there? It's a big, big picture window with a light in it. He said, when I say abracadabra, the light is going to come on. And when I say abracadabra, the light is going to come off. We was like, oh my God, really? So my dad says, abracadabra. And the whole window just lits up, ooh, like this, right? We was like, oh my God, we were so impressed. Like, oh, we got a magical dad, you know? And we was like, oh, how'd you do that? He's like, I told you I was magic. He's like, you want me to tell it to go off? We said, yeah. He said, abracadabra. And the lights just went off. Oh, my God. So we're super impressed by this.
Johnson went from having no father to having the best father she could imagine. It wasn't long before she learned his demonstration of magic powers was just a trick, the kind her father loved to play on the unwitting. But it didn't matter. She felt for her father something she'd never felt before.
At 14, I thought my daddy was magical and he was perfect and that, you know, he was my savior. You know, he was my savior and I just loved him so much. I don't think I ever loved anyone like that until I had my first child.
Later, Johnson would come to see that her dad was not perfect, but human.
I love my dad, but I have some stories that are not so sweet and not so happy. You know, I got pregnant at 16. My father wasn't feeling that at all. You know, he didn't speak to me for 6 months. So, you know, it's not always good. It's not, but, you know, thinking about meeting him and feeling that connection, finding somebody that look, you know how amazing it is to grow up to the age of 14 and feel like an outcast, and then you meet somebody, you're like, oh, that's me. That's me, you know? So it was, you know, it's an emotional thing, and it's something that always stayed with me. It's a connection that I can relate to.
As their relationship developed, Johnson learned her resemblance to her father was more than skin deep.
My daddy is very optimistic. You know, he's always trying to be encouraging. He likes to talk, but he also likes to listen. I think I got that. If you talk to my friends, you know, they'll tell you I will sit there and listen and give advice. We very much people person, you know, so I can meet you for the first time and we be laughing and getting along forever like we've been knowing each other. My dad is like that.
Johnson's children know her father as a mentor, encouraging them to value education and independence. He may be a grandfather now, but Johnson will always remember the young, playful smile she fell in love with all those years ago. I'm Brianna Grow.
The next to normal story slam is taking a month off, but we'll be back at the McLean County Arts Center September 20th with the theme Oops. Storytelling starts at 7:30. You can subscribe to the Next to Normal Story Slam podcast at our website, wglt.org/storyslam. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Stefan Szabo came to professional music at the relatively late age of the latter 30s. The founder of the folk Americana band National Park Radio says working full-time in IT after college, then getting married and having two kids at a young age kept him from pursuing his love of music at least full-time. Ahead of National Park Radio's appearance Sunday night at the Hallowed Hall in Bloomington, Szabo told WGLT's John Norton via Skype he has a different perspective than he would have at 18 years old.
For one, I'm kind of tied down to other things, so I have to be a lot smarter with my decision-making about it. And also, it's not like I'm super desperate to put food on the table because I've kind of maintained off and on just a normal job for the past 6 years. And I have a degree. I can always go back to like getting a normal job. So I'm not too worried about anything. I'm just having fun with it. At this point, it's gotten to the point where it's pulling me. I'm not necessarily pushing this project anymore. It's kind of pulling me.
Could you expand on that? How so?
Well, we have a good solid fan base that's like begging us to come out and play for them, you know? So like I had never come to the East Coast before or anywhere past Nashville. Like we were in South Carolina a couple nights ago and they were singing our songs to us. And it was the first time ever in that area and just lots of already mega fans built in. And so anyways, those people in these different areas and even in the places that we've already played, they're kind of wanting us and expecting us to come out and play music for them. So that demand is kind of pulling me away from my normal job to possibly doing music full time rather than me having to push it so hard.
Having never been in a band, been a musician or a comedian on stage where people are singing back the songs that you're playing, right? They're singing along to the music,
yeah,
or they're repeating
mm-hmm.
lines of a comedian. That has to be kind of a special kind of validation, doesn't it, when fans are singing along to the music that you wrote?
It blows my mind consistently. I mean, whenever we're playing in an area for the first time that they heard our music online, on Spotify, or somebody showed them our CD and they got hooked and they know all our songs. And so they're singing in the crowd. 3 or 4 years ago in Jackson Hole, Wyoming, somehow our CD got circulated in one of the camps around there throughout the summer, and there were like 75 people like just singing along to our songs, and we'd never played there before. It was just an insane feeling. But yeah, it's definitely a validation.
I want to ask you about some of those songs, and I want to focus on Old Forests, where I picked out at least three what I'll call love songs: Meant to Be, Rain Has Fallen, and Fame and Misfortune. But the first one, Meant to Be, let me play a little snippet of that.
I know life is somewhat predictable. We go home and walk right back out the door. When you call me, I will never say hello.
I'm taking this song to be someone that's in a relationship that's past infatuation and you're working through, okay, how do we deal with this now?
Yeah, I kind of wrote it from the perspective of just my own personal experience. You know, we'd been together for a while and been through all the, you know, early phases of the relationship. It just kind of happened, you know, like the engagement and to get to be together forever. We're just starting to plan the rest of our lives, you know, and then like, and it talks about how we fit together and we balance each other out.
Let's go to Rain Has Fallen, and this is just a beautiful love song. Where does the rain fit in on this?
My wife and kids travel with me now because my wife is in the band now. But before that, two, 3 years ago, up to when I first started, they didn't travel with me. So I was on tour without them, and so this song kind of came up.
Oh, if the rain is falling, it makes me think of you. And when the birds are calling, it reminds me too. But any moment now, Lord knows I'll be gone away. Oh, please remember how our hearts still beat.
The song is called Rain Has Fallen from National Park Radio. Our guest is Stefan Szabo from the band. This is WGLT Sound Ideas. You mentioned that your wife is in the band with you, or you're in the band with your wife. Did that take a few talking throughs to say, yeah, maybe this isn't a good idea, maybe this is a good idea?
Well, we went through, you know, the first 3 or 4 years of her just kind of supporting the band from the outside. We went through a little bit of a rough patch with like a management company and a studio that we weren't necessarily happy with the result and with the relationship. So that whole phase took me away from home a lot after that. And I decided to cut ties with those people and start something a little bit more fresh and authentic. I kind of talked her into being on the album Old Forest, which released a couple of years ago. I talked her into singing harmonies and things on that album. And then we, from then on, you know, we decided that since she was on the album, she's got to be in the band now. So they have to travel with us everywhere. So my two girls and her, we all travel as a family, along with a few bandmates. And it was pretty intentional on my part to be able to just keep the family together.
Well, we featured some songs from your Old Forest album. I want to go now to The Great Divide. I want to play the title track. So this is The Great Divide. It's a title track to an album you put out just a few more years ago from Old Forests. This has a different musical feel than the Old Forest album. Musically, it's a little more up-tempo in general.
Yes, it's a little more produced. This was created with a producer out of Texas. And, you know, it's not necessarily 100% the style I wanted. And so that's we kind of parted ways after that that album. So because I just felt it was a little overproduced, they were trying to like make it radio ready, and I was like, you know, I was a little resistant to everything, and so that's why I came out with the more simplified Old Forest shortly after this album was released. But The Great Divide, one of my favorite songs. It's one of my first songs that I wrote back when I was starting about 6 years ago.
Well, Well, Stefan, as musically proficient as you guys are, you seem to take a lot of pride, or as much pride, in your lyrics and storytelling as you do the music and the instrumentation of what you're doing as well.
Yeah, even more so, I think, than the music part of it. The songwriting, the melodies, the vocals are important. That's where the meat is for me.
Well, let's finish with one more song from the Great Divide album. It's called There Is a Fire, and I like this because it's suggesting people need to, you know, get out of a rut. People celebrate life and see the good things in life.
It's about just not letting the fears and frustrations of life get to you, and just keep the passion to do what you're, keep on going, really.
Come on, let's go now, go for a ride. Let's bring our kids, bring our wives down that road they call life. Let's do something that makes us feel that we're alive.
Stefan Szabo, National Park Radio, thank you so much for your time. We love your music, and a lot of folks looking forward to seeing you Sunday night.
Awesome. Thank you so much.
Look out that window. Look past your nose. Can you recall the path you chose? Those roads you passed by, you'll never
WGLT's John Norton speaking with National Park Radio band founder Stefan Szabo. The Folk Americana group plays the Hallowed Hall in downtown Bloomington Sunday night. Discover other local music and hear from artists playing in Central Illinois on the GLT Music Podcast. Find it on NPR One or your favorite podcast app. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal, made possible with listener contributions at WGLT.org. Our website is where you can find Sound Ideas interviews and stories as well, with help today from Ryan Denham, Dana Vollmer, and Brianna Groh. I'm Charlie Schlenker. You can subscribe to Sound Ideas on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, or NPR One. This is 89.1 and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.
There is a fire. There is a fire.